September 11, 2001, Al-Qaeda terrorists flew two hijacked passenger planes into New York City's World Trade Center.
This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center. CNN said
two more planes were hijacked, with one flown into the Pentagon in Washington, D.C.
We have certainly heard reports that another plane had been hijacked, a third plane in all, we now understand, and that there had been an explosion at the Pentagon. We're informed by our colleagues in the United States that this is smoke rising from the Pentagon.
The other, United Flight 93, crashed and killed all on board in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Passengers and flight crew had heroically attempted to regain control from the hijackers.
A hijacked plane crashed in Pennsylvania this morning, not far from the West Virginia border. This is one of the four planes hijacked during this morning's attack. It crashed in Somerset County, Pennsylvania, about 80 miles southeast of Pittsburgh. 13 News reporter Kane Farrell.
The 9/11 attacks were the worst on U.S. soil since Pearl Harbor in 1941, and they've left an emotional scar that many are still recovering from. The death toll in the World Trade Center is over 2,600. In total, 2,977 people would die, with many more thousands injured. From Highway 61, this is Spotlight 9/11, a four-part series telling the personal narratives of those who survived and witnessed the World Trade Center terror attacks. These are their stories told in their words.
I'm Rob Snyder. On September 11, 2001, I was 46 years old. I was a professor of journalism at Rutgers University in Newark. I'm a historian also. Today I'm the Manhattan Borough historian. On September 11th, I was on my way to teach at Rutgers when the towers were hit. It was a beautifully brilliant blue sky day that the night before had rained terribly. I was caught in a terrible storm on the way home from work. The morning came up, it was blue and it was clear. The sky was just impossibly brilliantly blue. It was a Tuesday, it was primary day. People were voting in the primary election to choose candidates for the voting in November. So my wife and I, after talking about it, decided to vote on our way to work. So we went and voted, and we got on the subway at East 86th Street and we headed downtown. She got off at 34th. I continued on down. It was my normal subway ride like any other. And as we got further and further downtown, I noticed that the train was beginning to run oddly. It was running slowly. It was making stops. It really wasn't going to get where we wanted to go quickly at all. Something was wrong because we were on an express train. And I remember looking across the aisle in the subway car, a guy sitting there in a very, very fancy-looking suit with a big Rolex watch on his wrist. He looked angrier and angry that the train was getting slower and slower. I was sort of laughing to myself, you know, you're a master of the universe, buddy, but you can't make the subway run time when you want it to. And then it skipped the normal stop that I got off at, which is the World Trade Center stop. The squawk box on the subway car said something. I couldn't understand what it was. I was baffled. I had no idea that there was anything going on up on the ground. And we continued on. We went to Wall Street, the next stop, and the doors opened. So I got out of the subway car and I walked up to Broadway and started to walk north on Broadway towards the World Trade Center, because my commute involved catching the PATH train in the underground portion of the World Trade Center that took you across the harbor to New Jersey. As I was walking up Broadway, I was on the west side of Broadway. I was close to the buildings lined up there, so I couldn't see very much right above me. I noticed that Broadway seemed oddly quiet. I thought it maybe had something to do with the primary election, that maybe there was some sort of political parade going on on primary election day, and I saw what I thought was confetti. And there's a tradition of ticker tape parades in Lower Manhattan. I thought, well, maybe this is some kind of political thing. Maybe there was just some celebration with some candidate who came through minutes before. And then I kept walking north, and all of a sudden, as I got to Liberty Plaza, I could see clearly right above me, I could see the two towers of the World Trade Center, and they were both on fire. The sight was just terrible. And my first thought was that I had one of my best friends working up there. He worked on something like the 65th floor. And I thought, oh my God, where's Frank? Is he up there? Is he going to get out of there? What's going on? He had been through the bombing in 93 and survived and helped a lot of people. But I was worried for him at that moment because it didn't look very good for the people in the building. I crossed over to the east side of Broadway, across from Liberty Plaza, and there was a small crowd of people standing there on the east side of Broadway looking up at the towers, just dazed, baffled, and upset at what they were seeing. I heard some people next to me saying, this is terrorism, this is terrorism. And I'll never forget, there was a man standing next to me saying, oh my God, will you look at that, will you look at that? I didn't know what he was looking at. I saw flames, I saw a huge amount of smoke. What I focused on was big chunks of debris that were being spit out from the towers. They're just exploding out of the side of the building in the flames. And I was worried because I thought if one of those big chunks of debris comes down on Broadway where I'm standing, that's going to go through the crowd around me like a buzzsaw. This is not a good place to stay. In retrospect, I don't think that's what the man was talking about. I think he was looking at people who were jumpers, who were leaping from the upper stories because they were trapped by the fire and they had no choice. But I looked up there. I wondered about my friend Frank, who was working up there. And I started to think, I've got to get out of here. What's the best way for me to get out of here? I was still fixed on getting to Rutgers to work. I thought that my job was to get out of there and then get to Rutgers and teach my classes that day. I thought about where I should go. I didn't want to walk directly north along Broadway because that would keep me walking along the plane of the towers where the debris was being spit out. I didn't want to do that. I thought the best bet was probably to head east, but I have to tell you, I was not really comfortable with heading east, because if that building went down like a falling tree, it would have squashed everybody standing on Broadway where I was. But nobody in the crowd, while I was standing there, thought the building was going to come down. The police officers were standing in the curb. They had their backs to the burning building. They were keeping the crowd on the sidewalk to make sure nobody would step into Broadway. They were clearly trying to keep Broadway clear for rescue vehicles. Nobody was talking about the building coming down. And then there was a huge crack, gigantic explosive crack. And what looked to me like the top third, the top quarter of the tower just exploded out. And the very top of the tower seemed to tilt towards us. It looked like it would maybe fall upon us. And the people in the crowd started to scurry away to head east. Keep going, keep going, let's go. My first thought, believe it or not, was don't panic, don't cause a panic, don't run, stay cool. But as I started to move, I saw that the crowd was beginning to run. And my big fear was that the top of the World Trade Center would land on top of everybody who was standing on Broadway. Optically, it looked like it could do that. So the crowd started to run, and I saw everybody running. And I thought to myself, well, the heck with this. People are running. I'm going to run, too. And I started to run. And we all ran east. And I looked over my shoulder once, and I saw an enormous sight. The building was collapsing. It was sending out huge, huge clouds of dark black smoke. That smoke and that falling building seemed to be headed for everybody who was where I was standing. So I started to run. I was pretty far back in the crowd. I didn't like that. I wanted to get ahead, but I didn't want to trample anybody. This has happened to me before in crisis situations. Suddenly, everything seems to go into slow motion for me for at least a few seconds, and I get time to think and plan. And the thing I thought about was, this is so absurd. My wife is working up in Midtown. My daughter and son are in school. They don't even know about this. And this is going on down here. And I thought I was going to die. I quickly thought about a friend I had who lost his father when he was young in grade school age. And my son was in about grade school age then. And I thought about how hard it was for my friend to grow up without his father. And I thought, I don't want to see my son have to do that. If I can have anything to do with it, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to try to live. And I just took off. When I was young in high school, I was a pretty good sprinter. Never on the track team, but I could always run really fast alongside guys who played football and who were sprinters. So I turned on all the speed I could. I started running very, very fast and weaving and dodging and cutting around people and between people. Pretty soon, I was up towards the front of the crowd. I went from the back of the crowd to the front of the crowd. And the scary thing that I saw was that other people stumbled over each other. So you'd see these knots of people lying on the ground, arms and legs tangled up together, squirming, trying to get up. And they looked terribly vulnerable because if I was moving and maybe getting myself to safety, they were tumbled up on top of each other. And it seemed to me that they weren't going to get anywhere. But I was getting closer and closer to the front of the crowd now as I was running. And I saw a sight that I'll never forget. It was a woman. She had dark hair. She was well made up. And she fell. And somehow as she fell, she spun around. And she was looking back towards the crowd that was running towards her. She was looking towards that huge cloud of debris that was boiling towards us. And the hundreds of people, maybe 200 of us, that were all running to get away. And she just opened her mouth and screamed, a scream of absolute horror. Because I think what she would have seen lying on the ground looking back towards the west was hundreds of people heading for her as if they would trample her and all that debris boiling down the street as if it would crush her. And for a fraction of a second, I thought I should help her. I was a garbage collector when I was a young man, so I know how to pick up very heavy loads with just one arm. And I thought, you know, if I hook her underneath the arm, maybe I can pull her up. But my second thought was, if I stop even for a fraction of a second to help her, somebody's going to hit me from behind. They're going to knock me down, and I'm going to wind up like that crowd of clusters of people that I've run past already, squirming on the ground, falling all over each other. So I pivoted, and I kept running. I didn't pick her up. All of a sudden, the cloud caught up with us, and everything went completely black. It was the strangest sensation because you went from being part of a crowd, knowing that you were one of a couple hundred people running for their lives, to feeling all alone. You couldn't see anything. And it went from very bright midday to completely black. I froze for a second and I you know, breathed in the smoke and it you know, I coughed. I remember something I heard from a firefighter when I was a young man, when I was a newspaper reporter. He said, you know, it's not the flames that get you, it's the smoke. And my thought was, oh man, this is the smoke. I kept listening for a sound, and I didn't hear any sounds. It was completely quiet. It was deathly. I heard a guy off to the side of me say, get low, get low, you know, get low and breathe the cleaner air closer to the ground. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to get down on the ground because pretty soon those people are going to start running again. They're going to trample me. So I did what I often do in difficult situations, to try to find the happy medium. I went into a deep crouch and I took off my hat. I wear a broad-brimmed hat to keep the sun off, kind of a cowboy hat. I took it off and I jammed it over my face like a gas mask, and I breathed a little in the... The hat caught the dust and the debris so that I wasn't choking on the smoke. It was noxious, but I wasn't choking. I looked around, I saw nothing. I did that a couple times, and then gradually, smoke began to lift a little bit, and I could make out lights in buildings nearby me. We were at midday. We were in downtown Manhattan, as bright a place as you can find anywhere, and these lights just looked to me like, you know, little beacons in the fog. As soon as I could begin to make out the rough outlines of buildings, I put my hat on and I thought, I'm out of here. And I started to head east. I thought east was my best option. I didn't want to go anywhere nearer to the towers. There was still one other tower up. What if that one fell? I thought if I headed east, I could get to the East River. I'd probably be in the clear there. I'm a good swimmer, I thought to myself. If I have to swim, I'm going into the East River. I kept walking really fast. I wasn't really running now. I don't think I was running, but I was moving really fast. I could dimly see the outlines of buildings, and it was confusing because there are plazas down there. There were short little streets that twist around. It's a colonial streetscape, not the grid like you find in the rest of Manhattan. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, off from the left, comes this man dressed as a businessman in a suit with a briefcase, and he's just walking as if he's in a trance. He's walking briskly with his briefcase, and he's just rocking his head side to side while he walks. And I grabbed him. I grabbed his arm and said, "Come on, we're going to get out of here. We're not going to die here." I grabbed this guy's arm and I said, "Come on, we're going to get out of here." And as if I woke him up. And he was holding one arm, and we headed off. We're heading down east. We saw another guy. It looked like a working guy, sort of very stocky, muscular guy. I grabbed his arm. I said, "Come on, let's get out of here. Let's get out of here." We were walking down a narrow side street when all of a sudden the door of a building opens up, and somebody pulls us in. Some people who worked in a food court had pulled us into the back entrance of the food court on a side street. So they pulled us in and then took us inside. And that got us out of the dust, that got us out of the smoke. Most of the people who worked in the food court were probably immigrants from the West Indies, from Latin America. The man who I guess was South Asian was running one of the food stands. And they were bustling around and being really helpful. You know, one woman gave me some water to drink. Another woman loaned me her cell phone so I could call my wife in Midtown and tell her that I was alive. My wife had been watching television, watching this thing unfold. She was glad to hear from me. And it took about 6 months later for her to confide in me what she had thought for most of the morning. She thought that I was dead because when she got to her office, she knew that the towers had been hit. People were standing in Midtown pointing towards the World Trade Center. And when she got to her office, she was watching it unfold on television.
It's 8:52 here in New York. I'm Bryant Gumbel. We understand that there has been a plane crash on the southern tip of Manhattan. You're looking at the World Trade Center. We understand that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. We don't know.
And she knew that I commuted through the basement of the World Trade Center.
We don't know if it was a private aircraft. We have no idea.
She thought I was dead. One of the guys who ran the stands was getting together big drink containers and filling them up with water. He had like a dozen of them on a tray. And I remember one guy who worked there saying, "This is terrorists, you know, this is terrorists." I remember another lady gave me a towel, a wet towel, that I could wrap around my face so I could breathe through it. And me and this one manager guy walked out into the street. We both had trays full of water, and we kept handing these big drink containers filled with water to everybody who came by. There were stragglers making their way down the street, and I handed away every single one save one, and I kept that one for myself. And I said, "Bye, I'm out of here," and I started to head north, roughly, to get out of Lower Manhattan. It was a very strange sight because Lower Manhattan is an old part of the city. There were some buildings down there from the 19th century, and I remember passing them and thinking, this is so strange. This is the oldest part of the city, and now it's going to be demolished, maybe, in this terrible disaster that's unfolding all around us. I kept heading north. By now, I was seeing more people. I saw a police officer, and I said to him, "You got any advice?" And he said, "Yeah, get out of Lower Manhattan." And I said, "Yeah, I'm on it." I kept walking, following the rough parallel of the East River towards the Brooklyn Bridge. And by the time he got to the Brooklyn Bridge, there were lots of people, throngs. You could see people heading over the bridge. You could see people walking in the streets. I remember one girl was on rollerblades, you know, trying to make good time. And there you saw police officers. You started to see some official figures, you know, trying to cope with the situation. As I was walking along, I was covered in dust. I mean, I'd been in the cloud for quite a while before it dissipated, and I was covered in debris and whatnot. We looked like refugees. It's the only image that came to my mind. We looked like people who were fleeing from some kind of a war. We didn't look organized in any way, and despite the best efforts of the police officers that they saw, it wasn't much they could do for us either, you know, except give us the advice to get out of town. As we headed north and got closer to the Brooklyn Bridge, I remember we walked over a grating, the kind of grating that you sometimes have at ground level when the subway is below. And I felt a rumble beneath my feet. And people started to look nervous because they felt it too. And I made some kind of crack. Don't worry about it. It's just the subway. And then I turned to look back and the second tower had fallen. And the sight was just apocalyptic. You saw all of lower Manhattan drenched in smoke. The light of the sun reflecting off the smoke, you know, made the sun look, to me, in my memory, a bright red or yellow. It just looked like the whole place was on fire. And as a historian, I think about the city as a place with many layers of the past. And what shocked me so much about the explosion downtown on September 11th was that it was not going to just take out people that day, but it was going to destroy a big chunk of our history. A big part of our past was going to get wiped away, not just in the World Trade Center, but in the side streets around it. Looking back on the World Trade Center from a distance as we crossed under the Brooklyn Bridge, it looked like all of lower Manhattan was going to boil up. I was wrong about that, but at the moment that I look back, it just looked like an apocalypse. So I kept walking. I passed underneath the Brooklyn Bridge, kept heading uptown, and I knew my way around. By now, I knew what had happened. I passed a public housing project called the Al Smith Homes. Al Smith was a great politician, did a lot for working people in New York City. And I was just so angry. I said, what are these guys going to do next? Hit the Al Smith Homes? I mean, what's their target today? How many innocent people are they going to kill? And I angled up into Chinatown. It's probably only a 15-minute walk from the World Trade Center site, but it felt like another world. There were construction guys working to put down concrete and repair a sidewalk in Chinatown. There was a family that had clearly gone to a church for a christening in Chinatown, and they were standing around with these awkward expressions on their face, like, well, you know, maybe things not going to work out today the way we thought. You know, they looked confused but not terrified. And where I passed through Chinatown by that time, I thought I had pretty much, you know, escaped with my life. I made my way out of Chinatown up into Little Italy, and I went into this Italian cold cut store, and I must have looked like a sight. I wasn't fully aware of how I looked. And everybody was kind of looking at me, and on one hand, they were giving me some room, and the other hand, there was a lady behind a counter. So I stepped up to the counter, and I said, you know, could I borrow your cell phone to call my mother and tell her that I'm alive? And nobody wanted to lend me a phone. And then the lady said, well, look, you tell me the number you want. I'll dial the number and then give it to you. I said, okay. So I did that. And she handed me her phone and I called my mom. By then, my mother had gotten word that I was safe because my wife called her mother once I rang her. And then my mother-in-law, then in Connecticut, called my mother in New Jersey and told her that I was okay. Phone service was totally scrambled in Manhattan, but you could make a call from Connecticut to New Jersey. So my mother was aware that I was alive, said she had never imagined me being caught up in this because she assumed I would commute through Pennsylvania Station in Midtown. I did that sometimes, but on that morning I was going through the World Trade when everything broke. I headed out and I set out to walk home. I wanted to walk home because I didn't want to get on a subway. I didn't want to do anything that would put me underground because I thought it would make me vulnerable. I thought as long as I was on the streets, I was on the open, I could get away. I remember walking through Little Italy and this older man was sitting on a stoop and looked like quite a tough guy in his own right. And he said, you know, I think we know who did this. And I said, you know, I think we got an idea. We'll have to see. And he said, well, whoever did this is going to be some payback. And I said, you're right, there is. I kept walking and I met this woman, so a bit older than me, and she was weeping. And I said, can I help you? And she said, well, my husband works in the World Financial Center. I don't know if he's alive. I don't know what to do. And I said, well, do you know anybody in the city? And she said, yeah, I know somebody who lives up in the 20s. I'm a little lost and confused right now, she said. And I told her, look, well, stick with me. Walk with me. I'll get you to a place where I can point you in the direction to your destination. And then we'll continue on with that and you'll be fine. And she was really grateful. And I sort of walked along with her and talked a little bit. And I just remember she was sobbing. She kept dabbing her eyes with a handkerchief. When we got up to the East Village around 8th Street, I saw a clinic that was open that was set up to help people coming out from the disaster zone. And I went up to them. And I said, you know, I was downtown. I was breathing all that smoke. Could you just do something to sort of clean out my lungs? And they put me on a thing that was meant to do that. And To my pleasant surprise, I hadn't sucked in that much dust. I mean, they were surprised and kind of pleased that, you know, I'd done okay. I'd gotten out of there quick enough that I wasn't, you know, choking, and I hadn't swallowed that much. I'll never forget, when I got up around the East 50s, I lived on East 81st Street, there were almost two worlds. There was a stream of people looking like me, covered in dust, walking out of downtown, and people having ordinary lunch breaks, you know, in the late morning, early afternoon. So I went up to this one restaurant. Staff is sitting in the window looking at all of us going by, and I knocked on the window, and I said, "Can I get a glass of water?" And they said, "No, we're closed." I looked at them, and I said, "You closed? Fuck you." And they said to me, "Fuck you." And I thought, good old New York City, you know? And then I went to a pub next door, Jameson's Pub. And I was at the end of the bar trying to get the attention of the bartender at the other end of the bar. And it was very crowded, and I couldn't get his attention when this guy off to the side of me says, "Here, buddy, you need this." He slides his scotch and soda down the bar to me, and I said, "Thanks," and I grabbed it and I drained the whole thing in a gulp. I kept walking, and I finally got home to East 81st Street. And I saw my wife, and we were together. It really wasn't clear what was coming next. I remember our television set was broken, which I thought was a good thing. We didn't watch the coverage of the crash and see it happen again and again and again. I went on email, and I caught an email from one of my students at Rutgers Newark, a very good guy named Naveed Iqbal. He said to me, "Professor Snyder, what is going on here?" And I said, "I have no idea, but I'm glad I'm safe, and thank you for emailing me." I wrote up an account of what I saw that morning. I sent it into the Ledger in case they wanted to use it. They used a paragraph from it in a piece that they published. And I sent a lot of emails to friends, and over the next couple of days did that a lot. Eventually, the account of what I saw wound up circulating around on the internet. A friend called me and said that, you know, he knew what had happened to me because he'd seen a version of my piece running around on the web. I worked the phones really hard trying to find out what became of my friend Frank Carville. I knew that he worked in the World Trade Center, and I didn't hear from him for a day or two or more after the towers came down. I kept dialing his home number in New Jersey, but I would never get through. I'd only get busy signals. He had relatives all over the U.S. and Ireland and the U.K. I figured they were talking to his family in New Jersey, going over the bad news. And then all of a sudden I got through.
"Hello?"
And he was alive, and I was overjoyed. I saw him at the end of that week. We had dinner together. He was leaving the tower with a lawyer at the moment that the planes hit, and they were getting into a taxi, and the taxi driver said, "Where you want to go?" And Frank said, "Out of here, straight across the Brooklyn Bridge." He was incredibly smart. He was very quick in a crisis, and the cabbie took him right across the Brooklyn Bridge, and he said he spent the day in Brooklyn Heights looking over the river, looking at the smoke in lower Manhattan, occasionally going off to pray in a church. He was not normally a religious guy, but on a day like that, a lot of people turned to religion, and so did he. And eventually he made his way home to New Jersey. He got on with his life after that. And then in 2004, he was in the New Jersey National Guard, had been for about 20 years. And he was called up to serve in Iraq and left behind his family and friends and his girlfriend. And in Iraq, he was killed in action. He died in an ambush in Sadr City. Some of the details are still a little confusing. We don't know for sure whether an IED got him and then an RPG or just an RPG, but they were hit pretty bad. He was very badly wounded, and he died not long after the ambush. For weeks after September 11th, you had a bad case of survivor's guilt. I looked at maps of the zone of destruction and figured out that I had started from the outermost place where the debris was falling. So I started from a place of relative safety, and quickly, you know, within 50 yards, I was actually pretty safe in retrospect. But I think of those people who I saw that were screaming in agony, like that woman, who were just lost in the debris. I think in retrospect about the people who jumped from the upper stories and died. And I would ask, why am I alive? What did I do to deserve this? And I gradually came to grips with the idea that, it was all a pretty random process who lived and who died, and I'd been lucky. And I also felt that I'd done everything that I could do to save myself. One of my students asked me about the experience, and he said, "How did you get through it?" And I laughed a little, and I said, "Well, once a Boy Scout, always a Boy Scout." But I do think I was helped by the fact that I'd been a Boy Scout when I was young, and it taught me a lot of things about self-reliance. I've spent a lot of my life in the outdoors, and I know how to do things physically that, most people don't know how to do. And lastly, I had grown up, I was born in 1955, I had grown up on stories from my dad, my uncles, relatives about their experiences in World War II. And the one thing that I took away from them was that ordinary people could do extraordinary things when they had to. And I summoned some of that up on September 11th. I wish September 11th had never happened, and I think it's a disaster and a tragedy. I still ache for the people who died. But I felt that I'd met a huge challenge and done as well as I could, and I was glad I did as well as I could. And that eased some of the survivor's guilt that I felt. I also, made a vow to keep on doing the work that I love to do and to make the most of it with the time that I got in my life, because I really did think I got a lucky break that day, and I've been glad that I've been able to do all the things I've done, teaching and writing and being Manhattan Borough historian since September 11th. But the courage of ordinary people, of firefighters, of police officers, of ordinary folks like the women in the food court who helped me, I think that's something inspiring, and I think that's something that should always be remembered.
This has been Spotlight 9/11, a Highway 61 production. This series was written and produced by myself, Gary Hayes. Our consultant producers for Spotlight 9/11 are Nick Lapworth, Jackie Ankelin, Neil Pacchietto, and Kerry Levy. Matt Alabaster designed our artwork, while Taylor Hayes has mixed the series. For more podcasts like this one, visit our website, highway61.media. That's HWY61.media. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at Highway 61_podcasts.